This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name's Fraser Spears, joined as always by Bradley Chambers. The show tonight is brought to you by our good friends at Jam Software, the makers of the Casper Suite, a great Mac and iOS-focused device management server that helps you keep your show on the road with large Mac and iOS deployments. Bradley, how are you doing?
Fantastic day. We are living the dream.
It's nearly Friday.
Yes. It's been a challenging week at home with our kids, and had a student in my office this morning for discipline issues. And you're asking, why is that my responsibility? And it's not, but our headmaster was at a eye doctor appointment, and his eyes were dilated. And I know the student pretty well, so I kind of got into his face a little bit and showed him who was boss.
That's what we do.
You know, sometimes you just need a male authority figure just to lay down the hammer.
From time to time.
Especially with little boys.
We had a teacher visiting us from Australia this week, and she remarked about how many men we had working at our school. She was surprised to see any at all.
Well, we want more, and that's the thing. We talk about that. We really want more male faculty, and I don't know if it's... I guess that's global that primarily teachers are female, but we don't have any... We have me, the headmaster, and then our PE teacher is male, and then the rest of it's female. Mm-hmm. So...
Yeah, I always think that's interesting, you know, when people talk about the lack of representation of women in tech, it's almost like the exact opposite world in education. You know, not so much in secondary education, but certainly in primary, you know, the proportion of men to women in that space is quite low.
And I wonder if it has something to do with, I guess, starting salaries for teachers aren't always most prudent for male how to have households. And so it maybe doesn't seem... I know a lot of men typically become teachers to be quickly become principals, you know, as fast as possible, I guess, to get the pay raise. So, it's interesting. It really stinks when we have large deliveries, because then I have to go pick them up. I mean, literally, true story, yesterday, I had to go pick up 40 boxes of pizza from Little Caesars because they couldn't deliver them that day. And, like, one day a month, we bring in Little Caesars for lunch. So I literally had 45 boxes of pizza in a... Acura car. So my car smelled like pizza the rest of the day. It was great.
There are worse things your car can smell of, let's face it.
Says the guy with a... coming from both of us, so we have kids and diapers. Yes, it's very true.
Yes, we do. Very much. So what's coming up? Anything coming up? I mean, for me, I've got some traveling next week. The Apple Leadership Summit is happening in London. And... But it sounds a little grander than it actually is. It's not all the leaders of Apple coming to London and me. It's an event that Apple puts on for interested parties, invited parties, actually, I think. Most people are invited through resellers or direct from Apple contacts. And it's just a day. I think I actually spoke at it last year, but this year I'm not speaking. I'm just attending. And I'm going for one day, and I think there's multiple days during the week, but you only get invited to one because they do kind of the same thing each day. And so I'm going down on Tuesday, getting on the sleeper train, which is good fun, because it turns out the hotel that they're having it at is just around the corner from where the sleeper train gets into London, so it's way more convenient to do that than to fly to the outskirts and then get a very expensive train right into the middle of London. So I'm going to go to that, see what's happening. If any listeners are going to be there, I'd love to say hi. I'll be in London all day, and looking forward to that.
Is the rumor true that you have out-of-school stickers to hand out?
I don't know if I can get that organized in time to say yes.
I'm kidding. That would be neat.
With our cool new logo, that would be great.
Yeah, not that anybody care. Yeah, we have a new logo, so is it showing up on iTunes yet? I haven't even checked today.
I don't think it is still. So, there were some questions about that, and it takes a while.
Yeah, like our podcast host said, it can take up to 2 weeks with iTunes to pick it up. So like if you subscribe in, like say Pocket Cast, for example, you can refresh the artwork by tapping and holding on the artwork. And a lot of podcast clients will pick it up over time. And certainly if you unsubscribe and resubscribe, you'll pick it up. There's like, with it being kind of not a hacked together standard, like the podcasting, like the RSS podcast workflow, it's, you know, it's not totally like there's one, you know, when you work with, especially with Apple, I mean, you're not uploading your files to Apple, so you're basically giving them a feed. So you're kind of just basically waiting on them to pick changes up in the feed. So
there's a fair amount of custom stuff happens in iTunes capable RSS feeds.
Yes, that's very true.
Extensions to the standard, shall we say?
Yes.
Always a good time.
Yeah, that sounds like a great conference. I'm trying to think. I've got a couple conferences coming up in April that I'll be speaking at, and then I've got some later on this fall. But I'm trying to limit my travel as much as possible this year, even bowing out of our yearly fifth grade camping trip, because I think my wife would punch me if I took any unnecessary travel with having a six-month-old at home.
Yeah, that's a hard one to negotiate.
It's like, hey, honey, I want to go on a camping trip with our fifth graders. Is that okay? And then I get hit with a frying pan, and then we move on.
Well, I'm trying to expand my travel, but only to hot places.
And places places that are paying you $2,000 to show up. No, I'm kidding.
I'll take that if it's going, but warm for a start, and I'm okay with that. I'm on a plane straight away.
Yes. what we want to talk about today is kind of something we've really never even talked about, is how we use technology to communicate to inside and outside of our schools. We all have various systems we use, whether email, phone messages built into our school management system, newsletter services. And so we kind of wanted to walk through our workflows, and it's interesting as I read over your notes how drastically different our school is from yours. I mean, there's literally nothing the same that we use.
Yeah.
And so I think if it's okay with you, I'll just kind of work through our workflows, and then we can kind of work through yours if that's okay.
Sure. Yeah, let's do it that way.
Okay. So as I mentioned on past shows, we use RenWeb, which I hate most of the time. And they have a built-in email service. So we get our contracts in from parents when they come in. We record their email addresses. And it has spots for two email addresses per parent. And we can actually do grandparent emails, although we don't get many of those. And so we can actually email out through that. And so we can actually, so teachers have the ability to email out their class through RenWeb, and it comes from their email address. So if any replies come in, it will, basically go back to their Google email address. And then that way, if parents update their email addresses with the school office, it's updated in RenWeb for them. It works pretty well. Our teachers are limited basically just their classrooms. Now, a couple people, namely me, the headmaster, and some other folks, have the ability to do mass emails. And so you can do things like send to custody, which is the parents, which that's what we do. You can send to students. We don't do that because we don't have any student email addresses on file. Or you can send to grandparents. And again, we don't have any of those. So that works pretty well. The issue we have with it on occasion is when it emails to another Google account, it typically wants to get flagged by spam because basically Google can tell it's coming from a Google Apps account. I'm guessing this, but it seems logical. They can tell it's coming from a Google Apps account, but it's not coming from Google servers because it's basically being spoofed. And it typically hits us for other staff members. Like if a staff member is a parent and we send out a message through there, it typically always gets hit by Postini because it's coming from, again, an internal domain, separate mail server. So that's the only downside with it.
Yeah, we're obviously Google Apps as well, and we have sort of moved away from using our Google Apps domain to email parents at all. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we get on to what we do, but we used to do it with just address groups in Google Apps. So we had like parents at Cedars, and we could, MD could email, or MD in the domain could email to that group and get a message out. But we sort of changed that a little bit, and we'll talk about that in a little while.
And we have, a lot of our teachers will go in and do that, build their own kind of groups in their address book for their parents at the beginning of the year. And I understand that because it's certainly a lot easier to use Google than it is to, say, use the RenWeb mail. Because it's an okay interface, but it's not great. It's not the greatest, especially because they're using the faculty web, not like the local desktop application, because it's PC only. And so that you don't even get, like, you can't even do HTML email, and doesn't have native attachments. You basically upload a file and insert a link to it. It's okay. The downside of when our teachers do that is, like, parents will update their email address with the school office, and then they won't update it with the teacher. And we don't know who's doing what, and we don't notify the teachers when the email addresses change because we assume everyone is using RenWeb. So, that's it is what it is. Now, they've got a tool called Parent Communicator, which can basically do SMS and phone calls. And we don't use that because it would cost us about $1,000 per year because it's based on per I think it's like $1 per student per month, or maybe it was 30 cents. So worked out to like $1,000 a year. And the reason we don't use that is because we don't do call outs for anything but just weather, like early dismissal, school cancellation.
Like an actual telephone call?
Yes, an actual telephone call that goes out. We literally would do that 2 to 3 times a year. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of schools, I know there's some ones near us that like they will use it for everything. Like, hey, soccer practice is canceled, or don't forget about your test tomorrow. And they'll call it, they can call it individual classes. And we just don't do that. We use email for that. So we had a company call us called Bright Arrow, and I'll have a link to them in the show notes. And they're a pretty cool company. It's a, I think it's like a literally like a 2 or 3 person company because I'm dealing with the president most of the time when I email them. And they are basically an outbound calling service. And the deal they give us, I think it's, I'm assuming they give us to all schools. We basically pay $1 per student per year, and we don't have to pay like a per minute or per call fee. Now I know for non-education schools, like it's based on per call. So we pay like $300 a year for that, and they actually built it so like we can do an easy export out of our Renwebed database, and then they can take that raw import and update our list. And again, so I update the list only when I think we're going to have bad weather. So I did that recently because we, you know, we were closed the day after coming back from Christmas break. It's pretty easy. Again, you can like it does SMS. We can set an outbound phone number, so like it actually looks like it's coming from the school, which is pretty nice. It's not like a out of area number, anything like that. You can actually initiate the call from the web, and you can either upload a WAV file or you can kind of input your cell phone number. It'll call you to record the message, and then it'll actually send it out. And it tells you if it reached them, if it hit an answering machine. It's nice. Like, it works well. And so if you're looking for a service like that, I mean, you kind of can't beat it. Again, it's called Bright Arrow. So, again, that's just for weather and things like that. We also use Google Voice, oddly enough, and basically under my administrator account, like I have an administrator account, you know, admin at our domain that never changes, and I registered for a Google Voice number, and that's basically our weather line. So I have Do Not Disturb turned on, and when we have changes in the schedule, like again, closings or things like that, I will just call in, because you can do it from a phone, and update the message, and we actually have quite a few parents that check that. So it seems to be working well. They're not having to wait on anything. They can actually call out.
Yeah, they can be active on it and see, check the status.
We also use, obviously, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We have a lot more parents using Facebook than Twitter. And when we cancel school and things like that, we have a lot of people that read it first on Facebook. That's what they tell us, I guess. Okay.
And do you handle that all yourself, or do you...
I don't.
Are you the only person that has the credentials to post it?
No. Our headmaster does a lot of that himself. I will occasionally post things. We use Hootsuite to kind of mass post for the fair thing, except for Instagram. Okay. And I'll do them occasionally, but mainly our development person and our headmaster will kind of manage those because they use them for kind of marketing stuff as well. And I want no part of any sort of Facebook account. Not my thing.
Yeah, you don't want that.
Then we use we have a Squarespace blog that our headmaster uses. He'll like find cool articles he'll link to and things like that. And then lastly, we do what's called the weekly notes home, and so we basically send home like a PDF newsletter once a week that goes out to all families. It's like, here's what's coming up for the week school wide, and then they also get a every homeroom gets a classroom overview. Basically, it's a list of what's due this next week, and that goes home. It's basically posted on our website, and we send out a link home every Tuesday for that. That's just over email. So yeah, that's kind of what we use. Again, it's kind of built around, majority of it's built around RenWeb and Bright Arrow, but it kind of works for us. It's really inexpensive, and again, generally no problems. Yeah, every time I screw up the outbound phone messages, I always think we should sign up for Bright Arrow. Or sign up for the parent communicator and not use the Bright Arrow. Because like what I did 2 weeks ago is I accidentally, when I exported the list, I included grandparents. So all of our grandparents got the call that school was canceled.
No.
Yeah.
You can't take that back.
Nope. You just, that's just out there. So that was 1,000 people. So that was good. So
good times.
That's us. Works well.
Yeah, we don't have anything phone-based at all, or at least I should say we don't have anything automated phone-based. We use phone calls for stuff, but we've never really looked into that. There's a company in the UK called, I think it's called Group Call, who do a similar kind of thing, and I've seen demonstrations where they can do things like they can hook into your registration system, and if any particular child doesn't get registered by, say, 9:20 a.m., it will automatically text their parents and ask them where they are and ask them to call a school, things like that. So I can see some uses for that, but I still like to think that people use email, but I think I'm probably wrong about that now. It's parents seem to be so tech-centric. You know, it's all about SMS or whatever. So maybe we could Apple script iMessage, I don't know.
Well, you know,
probably not, because it's been written after 2004, so it doesn't support Apple script anymore.
You know, it's funny, the majority of text messages I get now, like not iMessages, are two-factor authentication.
Yes. Yes. And that and my sister, whose real-time delivery requirements for SMS are so high that iMessage is not good enough for her, apparently. She's like, I can't possibly wait that long for an iMessage to show up.
I actually almost missed an appointment at my house today. I had a guy come in to swap my propane tank, and I said, hey, just text me or call me when you're 20 minutes out. Well, he texted me, and he doesn't have iMessage, and I didn't check my phone. And so I'm just used to checking it on my computer. And so he said he was 20 minutes out, and I got the message 15 minutes later. Good times.
Panic stations.
Yes. So I had to run home at lunch. So, but then, of course, internally we use basically Google Groups. We have like a BBS all email address. It's set up to anybody internally can do that. So and it works well. I mean, there are occasional times like something I send will get hit by spam, and I have to go. Then I check the moderation queue. If you know what, if you use Google Groups, you know what that is. But you know, again, it's not perfect, but it works.
Yeah, I mean, most of what we've done has been typically email centric. So for many years, we just used groups of email addresses. So we would gather a spreadsheet or a CSV export of parents' email addresses, and I would just dump them into, you know, 7 or 8 different groups, maybe 10 or 12 at tops, just pasting the list of addresses. For a while, in the early days, Google Apps wouldn't let you have groups of people who were outside your domain. And then they added that feature so we could just take the parents' email addresses, wherever they were, and put them into one of our groups, which is quite good. But then Google started sort of changing the way that groups worked, and they brought in this thing called Groups for Business, which provided, like you said, Bradley, a lot more kind of forums and different things. And we weren't really interested in providing like discussion forums for parents. We just wanted a way to mass email them. And at the same time, there were also some changes to do with if you replied to the list, that would actually start to be distributed to the rest of the list. So we had a couple of concerns about if parents maybe would accidentally reply to one of those emails. They would be replying to all, essentially, and their personal information might get sent to other parents in the list, which would obviously be undesirable if they were sending us any kind of sensitive information. So at the start of this school year, back in August, we decided to move away from Google Groups for communicating with parents and move to MailChimp instead.
Before we move on, let's thank our sponsor for this week, the fine folks at Jamf Software. If you've been a listener out of school for any length of time, you know a lot about Jamf. They are the makers of the incredible Apple-focused mobile device management software. So it's Macs, iPads, iPhones, and even Apple TVs. Their Casper Focus app allows teachers to quickly focus students' attentions on iPads, conduct secure exams within an app, select specific Apple TVs assigned to the class, choose and distribute iBooks, and they can also prompt AirPlay. If you're going to be at the BETT conference in London, they're at booth E360. If you're going to be in Orlando for the FETC event, they're in booth 1363. So be sure to stop by and tell them you heard about them on Out of School. We've talked about them at length in the past, and I'll post a link in the show notes if you want to learn more about kind of the process of installation and even how to run it on an Amazon EC2 server. I'll drop some links into the show notes so you can go and listen to those old episodes. But again, thanks to the fine folks at Jamf Software for sponsoring this week on the Out of School. You can learn more about them at jampsoftware.com, jamfsoftware.com.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, so I was just talking about MailChimp, and I think so far this has been a mostly successful experiment. I think what I would probably say is that it's more complicated. In fact, it's definitely more complicated than the old Google Groups way, because what we used to do is just email. It would be like P1 parents at Cedars, and then that email would go to all the parents of children in that class, and that was easy enough to do. The MailChimp way is certainly more complicated, and I think probably what it's ended up in is a slight reduction in the amount that teachers use it, but at the end of the day, it's not that hard. So what MailChimp has is normally what you'll do is you'll go into their web interface and you'll craft what they call a campaign, right? It's a marketing system, ultimately, and we're sort of abusing it a little bit for what we want to do. But you go in and you create a campaign and you target it at one of many lists. Now, we have several lists for our parents. We've got one for everybody, and then you've got one for each class in the school, basically. And what happens is if we get, say, a new pupil, I'll take their parents' email address and I'll subscribe them to two lists, the class-specific list and the all-parents list. And there are ways and means by which you can segment this in different ways. One way you could do it is you could take your all-parents list and you could just make what MailChimp calls segments of the list, or groups, I think they're maybe called, within the list, where you can say there are some subscribers in this list that get treated differently for one reason or for another. And MailChimp can do various things like who's the best opener of your emails and things like that. But we could do it that way. But the reason we made separate lists was because I wanted to use a feature called Email Beamer, which is MailChimp's feature where from a normal mail client, say from an iPad or an iPhone or even a Mac, you can send an email to a specific email address, and then MailChimp will reply to you with a copy of what's going to be sent, and you reply again to that and say send, and it sends it to the list. Now, the reason I wanted to do that was because all our teachers knew how to send an email to their class's parents, and I didn't want to break that workflow too much. So I just gave them out the email addresses and said, now send to this address instead, and then just reply send when you're ready to go. Those email addresses that MailChimp generates for their lists are, I think, 60 characters long and random at MailChimp.com. And that's obviously a kind of anti-spam measure. So what I did was I converted those into V-cards and exported them out of my address book and emailed that to every teacher. And I said, add this to your address book. And that way you can just auto-complete those parent email list addresses as you type. So that was quite a good feature, but there's a problem at the moment with MailChimp, which is that you can't have an email beamer into a segment of a list. Because ideally what I want, right, is I just want one list called all the parents in the school, and then segments in each for each class. And then, you know, there's parents who have pupils in different segments and so on. But MailChimp can't do that. It's either one segmented list and you've got to go through the web interface, or you want to use Email Beamer, you've got to have separate lists for that. So we went with the separate lists so that we could use Email Beamer. It's, you know, it's a choice you make, because I didn't want to have to train everybody in how to use the MailChimp mail interface, the web interface rather. Not that it's hard, but just I didn't want to have to go through that right now.
Do you ever have any issues with parents unsubscribing from the list?
I haven't noticed very many, no. You get a report, I think a weekly report about activity on your lists, and most often what happens is ones that I've unsubscribed, because parents will write to me and say, look, I've changed my email address or whatever, and I'll go in and take their old email address out and put their new one in, and that's the end of it kind of thing.
Yeah, MailChimp, you know, in my experience, is pretty easy to use. I actually had a tweet with their fraud department this week, because I noticed I started getting emails from a local marketing company that I never had signed up for their email list. So I went unsubscribed, and it says, hey, you've unsubscribed from the list, LinkedIn Marketing Contacts 2014. And so obviously they had just like scraped LinkedIn. And so I said, hey guys, you know, I sent them a tweet and said, this person looks like they're, because that's against MailChimp's you know, terms of services to add people with, they basically don't know. So they actually suspended the account. So I kind of felt bad after that. But hey, got to follow the rules.
Well, I think you've done humanity a favor.
True. So how, I mean, when you have them segmented in lists, if people have never used MailChimp, so like if there's one email address, like if you have it in two classes, that, let's say they have two kids, and then the all you know, all parents list, do they count that email three times, like towards your, you know, quota on different pricing plans?
I'm not sure about that, because we're nowhere near the level at which MailChimp would actually charge us any money. I mean, I think it's, I don't even know what the limit is, but it's way beyond. It's like 2,000 emails a month for free, and we've got, you know, what, maybe 150, 200 max emails on our list, and we're sending maybe two or three a month. So it's not huge in any way. But typically, we'd either be sending to all the parents in the school about some general thing. Like just today, our telephone system went off, and the symptom of our telephone fault was that to the caller, it sounded like it was ringing, and no sound was being produced in the school. So we realized this about 10:30 in the morning. I'm sure some people had phoned us and not got through. So I quickly fired out an email to all parents so that everybody got that. But if you're sending to a specific class, and typically that's more something a teacher would do, send to their class about maybe homework or something like that, then they're all counted separately, because I suppose they would double count the subscribers, but because our numbers are so small, we're not close to having to pay for that just yet. Next thing about MailChimp that's quite interesting is the way that they handle things like templates and attachments. Because one of the features that the email beamer doesn't support is sending an email with an attachment. And we would do that for things like our newsletter, which we would produce in a PDF form and then email it out. So what you do is, for that, you have to use the MailChimp web interface. You upload the file. MailChimp will actually host the attachment, and they will send a link to that as part of the email. That's quite good, because what that lets you see, there's analytics that go along with this. And you can see, obviously, how many people open your email and so on. But then you can also see how many people clicked your attachment. And that's been a bit of an eye-opener, because not as many people read our newsletter as we thought. and not as many people read as many things as we thought. I mean, I think every school administrator thinks that every single word you send home is treated as gospel, and people are just desperate to know what you're saying about what's going on. But in fact, you know, people are busy and they've maybe got better things to do than read about the craft fair or read about the sponsored walk or something. So it's been interesting to see what gets an open and what doesn't. And going along with that, all the usual caveats about, you know, undercounting of opens on Gmail and things like that. So that's been interesting to watch. And in particular, some of the bigger things we sent home, you know, how many people read that, how many people didn't. And sometimes we sort of record that as part of our consultation evidence to say, you know, we talked to parents, you know, here's how we sent it out, here's how many people looked at it, and so on. So, you know, so far that's been a fairly smooth transition, even if perhaps for some of the more complicated emails I've had to send them myself. And teachers will email me a file they want sent out to all parents, and I'll just put it together. But the templates are really good in MailChimp, so you can actually make your own templates as well. I've taken a couple that they have sort of a standard, and I've turned them into Cedars branded templates, and then we can just pull from them, type in what we want, and just fire it out. So it's pretty good so far.
Yeah, I've been impressed when I've used MailChimp. It looks, I mean, you can take, you know, minimal amount of text, use one of their templates, drop in a header, and it looks like a professional newsletter, and you spend about 15 minutes on it.
Yeah. It's really good that way, and I think once you kind of get into the way of their workflow and what you have to do, and there's a few things you sort of typically would do, you know, you put in your header image, you put in some text, you maybe upload an attachment, then you check the plain text, and then they have a really nice thing at the end where they say, well, you've done this step, you've done this, and this, and then today as I was sort of sending that one out in a bit of a hurry, it caught that I had missed one thing that I was supposed to have filled in, and then I had to go back and fill it in, and then move on from there. So it worked really well.
I like how you can schedule messages. So like if you were queuing something up to send home about an announcement, say tomorrow, you can go ahead and get it queued up and just have it ready to go.
Yeah, and that's helpful as well, because the way I view that sometimes is if I draft something, what I'll do is I'll draft it and schedule it to be sent maybe the next day. And then in between times, I'll go and see the people who I need to get approval from and say, is this okay? And if they say yes, then I can just, it's finished. And if no, then I've got time to go back and change it. But then I don't have to like remember to go back and send it again. It's quite a handy little trick. I think they call that a life hack. So
yes, 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 absolutely. You know, I've often considered, you know, I mentioned RenWeb and some of the frustrations with it. And in some ways, it would be nice to have kind of a dedicated system for this that would, you could make kind of nicer newsletters. I guess the challenge for us would be, because we've got so many families, would be kind of maintaining two systems.
Yeah, I mean, we basically take a CSV export and just dump it into MailChimp. Although it's not super easy because I'm maintaining so many different lists, I've got to sort of go in and select segments of that, you know, the first class, the second class, third class, and put them all into their separate lists as well. So, but at the end of the day, I mean, what is it? It's like 2 hours work maybe at the start of the year, and then it's up and running, and then it's just maintenance after that. You know, we change it every year, but then that's it. So, yeah, the biggest piece of work is always just to do the transition. And once you're through that, it's fine.
Yeah.
You mentioned, Bradley, that you guys use Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and so on. We haven't really gone down that line much yet. We have a Twitter account that we use, but we primarily only use it for like bad weather stuff, just when we want to get the word out on every possible channel that we can. We put it on our blog. We put it on our Twitter and also send email as well. But most of our stuff is still very email-centric, except for our school blogs, which have been a thing more in the primary department than secondary, but we're trying to kind of get our rate of publishing up in secondary as well. But for years and years now, we've used previously Blogger, and now we're using blogs that are built into our website, which is built through this Weebly system you may have heard of.
Yes.
We use that. It's not great, and you know, the problem you always have is that people, these web people sort of make a thing, you know, here's a CMS or whatever, and oh yeah, we've got an iOS app. And usually what happens is that when you scale up beyond like 2 authors, the iOS app just falls over because they built a bad one. And Weebly's a bit like that. We've just had interminable problems with posting from phones and iPads. And because that's what our teachers want to do. You know, they're so kind of mobile now that if something doesn't have an iOS interface, it basically is not getting used to its full potential. And that's true of iTunes U, and it's true of Weebly as well. And I think we've been through several systems for our website and blogs, and everything's just a constant disappointment because these people just build such terrible iOS apps. And I wish somebody would do a much better job, but so far, a few people have. Yeah, so Twitter's basically our only real kind of capital S, capital M social media presence, and it's not much of a presence there either, but maybe that'll come in time. But it's not like we have parents phoning us up going, why aren't you in Twitter? Why aren't you in Facebook? So, you know, there's only so many hours in the day, and you've got to do the thing that gets you the most hits. But our school blogs are really popular, and they're very popular also with grandparents as well, and maybe grandparents who live at a bit of a distance. And I know that if of all of these things that we're talking about, if we ever took away the school blogs, there would be just an almighty riot, because it's one thing that people like and enjoy that we do. Well, I hope they enjoy more things than just that, but it's something that's very, very popular with parents and also with grandparents. So we do as much of that as we can. And I suppose the last thing I was going to say was that we thought, when we started using iTunes U a couple of years ago, we thought that a bigger thing in homeschool communication would be parents subscribing to the iTunes U courses that their kids are taking. And that really hasn't turned out to have happened so far. You know, we've sent emails home saying, you know, if you've got an iOS device, we can give you the course to subscribe and so on. And I think maybe one parent total has come back and said, yeah, I'd like to be subscribed to all my kids' classes. We haven't really pushed it harder again than that, but you know, I'd hoped that would have become a bigger thing by now, but maybe not. So that's kind of our primary systems. You know, we've had some pitches on other things recently, and we may move to a few different things for telephones later on. But so far, that's pretty much what we do.
Well, and I think you're right. I mean, you have this fine balance between trying to do everything or just saying, look, this is what we do to communicate. And we do this well, and it'll always be there. So come where we're at. And
yeah,
you know, and we've, going back to what you said about parents not reading your emails, inside of RenWeb, I can see if the email's been opened or not. I can't see if they clicked on anything. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of crazy how few of them get opened. And it's also frustrating for us as a school if a parent says, hey, we didn't know about that. And you want to be like, what else did you want us to do? Like, hand a letter to you at your door and serve you with papers and say, hey, you read this. Because you feel like you almost got – and so you almost feel like you have to do this stuff. So, you know, you might – you know, if just the email would get 20% of the people to read it and posting it on Facebook and Twitter bumps it to 30, and then all these things you do gets it bumped up, you almost feel like you've got to do this stuff so parents will be in the know. But it can be very frustrating.
Yeah, it can be. It can be. And now – you know, at some level, I wonder if maybe text is actually the way to go. You know, just blast out SMS, say, check your email for what we just sent. I don't know. That's the one thing it's hard to miss is an SMS message.
Well, and see, I think a lot of this stems from weather announcements. I think I mentioned on past shows, we share a building with a church as well, and we share a telephone system. And so we really harp to our parents, hey, if you're concerned about early dismissal or school closing on the following day, please don't call the number, because we share this with essentially another organization. We will let you know. Just watch your email. We will call you. And, you know, it's just, again, it's always a balancing act. But it's kind of just kind of crazy to think that when you and I were in school, I mean, I was sitting there watching the news and waiting on the school closings to come by, and you'd catch it and be like, you know, my county when I was growing up was started with a C. So you turn it on, it was already at the D's, and you have to wait for it to cycle back through. And now it's just like, wait for your email to come through. That's all you got to do. Yep. It's like the news is almost like the last place you check.
So Bradley, what do you do for internal communication? Do you just have email lists for specific groups of staff?
Or? Yeah, we use Google Groups for that. Mm-hmm. We've got four. We have an all group that's all staff. We have a teachers group that pretty much is all staff, because over time people say, hey, I need to be informed of what the teachers know as well. So we end up adding everybody to that. Might as well just use the all group. And then we've got an office staff. And so like if teachers need to let all the office staff know something, it would be myself, our two headmasters, our academic counselor, and, you know, and our school secretaries. They would use that. Maybe it's about something kids going on with a kid, medicine, or something like that. And then we have a teacher's assistance group. So, like, if our assistant head of school kind of handles, you know, keeping them in the loop on things, because they don't often, you know, have time to go and check their email and things like that. So, you know, during the day, so she'll email them kind of a daily wrap up. Hey, this is what we talked about in faculty meeting. Here's what you may need to know and things like that. So, yeah, Google Groups works pretty well. It's not perfect, but it's free and it's built in. So and I like it too, because I can actually control on a person by person basis. Hey, you can send a group message and this person can't do the all message. Things like that.
Yeah, we've used similar. I mean, we just have we've got staff and we've got staff and admin. So some. The staff thing only goes to teachers, and then the staff and admin goes to teachers and office staff as well, so that everybody kind of knows what's going on for the most part. The admin people don't always need to know about, like, you know, curriculum stuff that's going on or whatever, but if there's any kind of organizational stuff, then it goes to everybody. So that's how we run that.
My nightmare is that we will somehow send an all-parent message that is only meant for one parent. Like, it would be like a discipline issue, or hey, your kid is failing this class, and we would somehow screw that up. And so in RenWeb, I can set pretty good policies on that on a teacher by teacher basis. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, like, if let's say our art teacher needs to send home something to all parents, like one of the admin staff has to do that, because we want those things to be proofed ahead of time. Like, everything that goes out, certainly to all families, has to be proofed. We have two people in here that kind of balance each other out and proof it. And just so we know, like, it, you know, I'm used to that system enough, and it's not the most efficient thing in the world, but you'd much rather be a little slower on something like that than screw it up.
Yeah, I think that's what I like about using MailChimp and having like an internal directory of parent contacts, because if you want to send to one parent, you know, if I wanted to email a computing student's parent, I could just go in and find in their pupil record, find their parents' contact email address and send that. And I would just do that directly to their email address from my mail client. Whereas if I want to do something that will go to a multitude of people, I have to go into MailChimp and do that. So it gives a reasonable boundary between, you know, individual emails and sending something en masse. And also the fact that MailChimp will, when you do an email beamer to the, to say, a, you know, a P7 parents email, it will not send it until it sends you back what you were expecting or what it thinks you should want to send, and then you reply with send. So there's a kind of confirmation step before it goes out to everybody. So that's another good check. Because if you thought you were just emailing one person and then you got back this thing that said, please confirm your email to all parents or whoever, that's another handy check on that as well.
Yeah, well, again, you'd rather be safe than sorry on those kind of things, because it's, to me, there's nothing worse than screwing something up on an all-parent list. I did that, I guess, last year. I send out the lunch menu every month just so mm-hmm. parents can, hey, we usually send it out. Like, I sent it out yesterday, for example, and it's like, hey, here's what's coming up for lunch. So as you're buying groceries, you know, here's, you can plan around what we're having. And I was sending out, and I have a text expander script, and I was sending out for, like, I think it was March, and I put in February because it was still February. And, you know, obviously I got a couple emails back, like, hey, did the February menu change, or is this supposed to be the March menu? So then you have to, like, send another email saying, correction, it's supposed to be a March email, and it's just embarrassing. And we were sending home our notes home this week, and now we post them all on the web, and I just send out links to everything. And one of the parents happened to check it and emailed me and said, hey, one of the links is not working. I had not even sent it yet. We were still like kind of prepping it to get on there. And then, so we fixed it, and then I still hadn't emailed her back. And then she replied back again, hey, it's fixed now. And then what the error was we were sharing like a, we'll often share like Google spreadsheets that parents can like sign up for things with. And mm-hmm. the teacher had not set the sharing preferences right where people could edit. Okay. And so, yeah, it's like, yeah, parents, and it's like parents are keeping you on your toes. So you just want to put like your best foot forward. You want to seem like you know what's going on and you have your stuff together. And we don't, like, often, like, I'm usually flying by the seat of my pants on a lot of these things, but you want to appear that you've got it going on.
Absolutely. I mean, it's all about presenting a professional face, and it's amazing how few organizations actually manage that these days. We do our best to, you know, but we're all just human at the end of the day.
Yeah, what did Steve Jobs always say? We're just people running these companies.
Yeah. So I guess that's communication methods. I feel, you know, it's possible to really overthink this. I think I've always tried to keep this as simple as possible. But at some level, as the school grows and as technology grows, complexity sort of grows with it as well. So, you know, we've tried not to create too many inboxes for us to check. I mean, we have one email address for people to email the school. It's just info@cedars.com. Parents do know teachers' individual email addresses. They either are or they were listed on our website, but they're not a secret. I mean, parents do email teachers directly all the time. But, you know, I kind of feel that if we were to go heavily into an Instagram presence and a Facebook presence and a Twitter presence, then that's another three inboxes that somebody's got to check in case, you know, a query is coming in over Facebook or a query is coming in over Twitter or even an Instagram comment that is actionable in some way. And I'm always concerned not to just invent more work when we don't really have to. And I think that's something that I kind of keep in the front of my mind all the time when we think about, should we expand something? Probably not if we can get away with it is usually the answer.
Well, no, that's a great idea. Like RenWeb has a parent calendar and we don't use it. And we have like a Google calendar that's embedded on our websites that makes it really easy for us to add things. Then parents can actually subscribe to it on their phones and sync it with their, you know, iPhones or Android devices because it's a public calendar. Mm-hmm. And we had one parent saying, hey, I was checking the calendar in RenWeb and why aren't things there? And it's like, well, that's a valid point because that's the system we use, but the calendar stinks and it like takes forever to add things.
Yeah.
So
yeah. How do you handle that? Like who can publish to your public calendar? Is it just one or two people?
Yeah, it's just like me, the headmaster, and his assistant are the only people that can do that. And you know what? It's not like classroom activities. It's school-wide stuff like basketball games and, you know, third grade Christmas programs. And one of the big things it's used for is we have a six-day rotation. So we have six resource classes. So when I say resource classes, I mean like Spanish, library, things like that. And so they rotate. Each class rotates on a day-by-day basis. Well, obviously, there are 5 days in the week. And there are six classes, so it kind of rotates. So, like, today, if today's day six, Monday will be day one, Tuesday will be day two, and vice versa. And what really screws us up is, like, I will do that, say, like, a month in advance. And then if we have a snow day, what we do is we don't skip a day. We just, if Monday was supposed to be day three and we're closed Monday for snow, Tuesday becomes day three. So then I have to go bump that completely back and you know, kind of creates kind of some chaos the next day because people are wondering if we've changed it or not and what we're actually on. So, yeah, it's just me, the headmaster, and his assistant are the only people that can add stuff to that. Anybody can view it, but only we can add.
Yeah. We have similar kind of thing. The way I fudged it a long time ago was I created an additional account in our Google Apps called Diary at Cedars. And we just have one password that everybody shares. So the private calendar is our subsidiary calendar. Our main calendar, and then the public calendars is a sort of delegated calendar from that account. So people who have the credentials for that account can log into and see both calendars on their device. But then that also means that everybody can edit it in both ways. So, you know, maybe at one point in the future I'll change that, but at the moment it's what it is. But you do occasionally get the thing where, you know, a teacher will put into our private calendar, shared private calendar, their personal schedule or whatever. So I'm occasionally emailing saying, whoever put that thing in about going to the gym, could they please remove it from the calendar? Fortunately, not that much. I don't think anything's ever made it to the public calendar, but I've certainly seen a couple of people's workout schedules on the private calendar from time to time.
It's like, I'm not sure why your kid's dentist appointment is of concern for the rest of us.
Yeah, and then they set alarms on it, and then the whole school just goes beep at the same time.
Oh, yeah, man.
So, why is calendaring so hard? I mean, you know, couldn't it be easier somehow? I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, I feel
Google Calendar's good for that because you can embed it in your website, which is a useful feature.
Yeah, I agree. And Chris, I remember back when we were starting the show and we didn't have a shared calendar and we were just sending meeting invites. Like, I was always paranoid that, like, I was hitting accept on the recording time and then you wouldn't get it. And I remember we joked then, like, how is this still, like, a concern? How is this still not work perfect? But I think it's one of those things, there are just so many ways to do it that it's so hard to make a calendar that's usable but also simple. And I feel like Google gets it pretty close. I certainly feel that Google Calendar for our purposes is simpler than like an iCloud calendar. It's easy to add stuff and things like that. But I don't know. That's like that address book to me are like still one of those things that's incredibly... There's just so many variables there that it can be complicated. I actually have a blog post coming out here in a couple of days about why I only have 63 contacts in my phone.
Really? I've got hundreds, yeah.
Yeah.
I should maybe tidy that up, but I feel bad. Like, these people I've never ever phoned, they've just got their phone number, you know.
Well, see, that's what the article is about, is like how to create... that. The title of the article is, Your iPhone is Not a Rolodex. And you know, basically the premise of the article is I store the people that like I might need to contact twice a year or once a year or once every 2 years. Those people are in Evernote.
So do you use Evernote Hello?
No, just that? it's really simple. Like, so what I do is I have a note that's called miscellaneous work contacts and miscellaneous personal contacts. And so, like, let's say Jim Smith, for example, I want his number. And I want his email address, but I don't want him on my iPhone contacts. I basically, in a note, just type Jim Smith - phone number - email. And then the next person goes on the next line. It's incredibly simple. Now, one thing you might could do if you've got all these people in address book and you didn't want to take the time to retype it, is to screenshot a person that you wanted to delete. Then delete it out of your address book. Then make a notebook called like miscellaneous work contacts. Upload that photo to a note. Title it their name. And then that's it. And so if you ever needed it, it would be there, but it's not going to be in your contacts list.
Yeah. Do you have any people that you keep in your contacts list just so you can see the caller ID when they call and then voicemail them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's about 5 of the 63.
I have a couple of people like that, I suppose. But if your call went to voicemail today, don't think it wasn't me. It was just the phone. I noticed that Evernote also have business card scanning now in the Evernote app itself.
Mm-hmm.
Evernote Hello used to be this kind of meeting acquisition thing where you could photograph the business card and stuff, but a lot of that seems to be moving back towards being a feature of the Evernote app instead.
Yeah, I think that's always the challenge for these services that do so much, is do you try to make it into one app or you try to separate it out? And I saw an article, I think, yesterday about how Facebook plans in 2014 to do more separation. So it'll be more things like Facebook Messenger. And for something like Facebook, I could see that being a good thing because, you know, there's a reason I like Instagram over Facebook because it's drastically simpler. But like with Evernote, I don't know that I want 5 Evernote apps on my phone.
Well, it's clear that they've tried that. You know, they've tried to unbundle certain features and stick it all into the back end of Evernote. And I think the only one that's really hasn't been completely subsumed into the Evernote app is Penultimate,
mm-hmm.
which is a very, very specific kind of app. And I like Penultimate very much. But it seems to me that Evernote Hello and Evernote Food and so on are sort of slowly getting folded back into the app or abandoned, perhaps in the case of Food. I don't know. It doesn't seem to get a lot of love or attention these days compared to the main app. And many of the key features of Evernote Hello are going back into the app itself.
Well, and I think the challenge with an app like Evernote is when you make an app for, say, food, you're pigeonholing food into one simple workflow, where you may have a drastically different recipe workflow in Evernote than I do. We're still doing recipes, but just the way we do it is different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you put one specific conception of what it means to work with handwritten notes or food or business cards, whereas if you just put in a card camera into the app, then people can do whatever they like.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. How did life get so complicated?
iPhones.
iPhones, yeah. I mean, this is one of the interesting things about it, I think, is that, you know, the camera, I was having this conversation in school earlier, like the camera on an iPad is not a photography device, despite what Apple's recent adverts might have you believe, but I really feel its main purpose is data capture. And I think there's some really nice workflows can be had with using the camera for data capture. Maybe that's probably a whole other show's worth of talking about, but it's relevant to Evernote because taking a photograph of something and sticking it into Evernote is a really big deal. I mean, maybe we should do another Evernote show at some point and just talk about... because it's been a while since we talked about it, and some of the new features are pretty cool.
Yeah, I actually used the heck out of that post-it note feature they added.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting. I've never done it.
Yeah, I don't like a lot of times I keep a post-it note at my desk with a pen and I'll scribble things down. Maybe it's something I need to remember for that night and I'll just take a picture of it. And yeah, it's actually pretty good about OCRing my chicken scratch handwriting.
Yeah, I've actually recently started using Penultimate again and using some of their custom papers to kind of manage my day and things like that. So, and of course that all syncs back to Evernote as well. So.
Well,
we should probably have a chat about that at some point.
And, I really am enjoying what they've done with Sketch, how it's still integrated in with Evernote, but it's not like it, you know, it feels like you're opening Evernote when you open Sketch. So I like Evernote's path. I had a blog that came out the other day about their software quality, and their CEO was basically writing a blog responding to someone else,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of basically lambasting them. And it's refreshing to see a company basically say, like, we agree that we have done some things that aren't perfect and we're getting better.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's so much scope for improvement. I'm so sort of still optimistic about Evernote, like, despite, you know, what I think have been some missteps, in particular the version 5 Mac client I thought was really not very Mac-like at all. How they won an Apple Design Award, I'm not absolutely crystal clear on either. But I think they're people who have the right attitude to it. And I think that's what gives me the most optimism. It's why I want to stick with Evernote, is because even, you know, they'll make some missteps, but they tend to know that they've made them. I'm sure they've got enough users that they certainly hear about it regardless. And the way I look at it is, since I started using Evernote, are we in a better place now than we were when I started? And the answer is unquestionably yes. And I think that's what gives me the most hope for the future.
And I think particularly with their iOS 7 version of Evernote. Now, I know people have said it's not as, you know, there have been some bugs with it and things have not worked as well. But the overall usability of it for me is the best it's ever been on iOS. And that's one of my primary means of using Evernote is on my iPad, is on my iPhone. And I agree, the Mac version is not perfect. And in some ways, I missed the previous version because it felt more... It felt like it took more advantage of what a desktop app could do, and it feels like the Mac one is almost trying to, you know, it's using that cards or that stacking thing that the previous iOS one did. And I would like to see, you know, when I'm using a Mac, I want to use an app that feels like it's a Mac app. And I'm not a big fan of apps are basically just ports or apps that are ports of their iOS apps. Like, you know, show me something that's built for the Mac and take advantage of what the Mac can do.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, Evernote 5 for the Mac almost felt like it wasn't even like an iOS app. It was like somebody had done a web kind of design and turned it into a Mac app. Because that whole sidebar where it's like separate, they're all kind of like jump points into different parts of the database. That's not how a Mac app works. There's a containment hierarchy that starts on the left-hand side, and then you click on something there, and you get the next thing, and then you get the next thing, and you get the master and the detail, and then sub-detail. And that's the way a Mac app should work. Instead of having the top level be these kind of jumping points and into random, like almost deep linking into parts of your database, which is kind of how the Mac app works at the moment. And I think, I certainly hope there's an update in the works that brings it back to being a bit more of a Mac application. And if anybody ever wants some suggestions, you know, call me. As if I'm the guy who you're going to phone. But anyway, the point is, I'm sure they know about this, and I'm sure they're working on it, which is more than can be said for some other, perhaps more definite forms of software design. Where, because Evernote's had so many forms already. I mean, you know, if you think about the different iterations the iOS client's gone through, you know, it's almost like I've had three different apps over time. You know, the early versions, which were pretty basic. Then we had that one with all the notebooks in it, and now we've got this one. I think this is probably the best Evernote I've ever had on iOS. And it's more like the Android version. You know, like a year ago, I had an Android tablet to play with, and I actually, back then, I liked Evernote on Android better than I liked it on iOS. And I think what I've got now on iOS is like the iOS version of that really good design that was on Android back in the day. So very happy with it so far. On iOS, bugs notwithstanding.
Well, and they're always particularly bugs. With the new iOS 7 APIs, it's basically always updated, which was one of the things I know you liked about the Android, is it was always, you know, checking in and making sure it had the latest copies. And, you know, now it can, it's basically, as long as you leave it running, it's basically always staying in sync.
Yeah, super happy with that. Good stuff. Shall we wrap it up there, brother?
I think so.
Okay. Where can people find us? Can we beg for stars? It's been a while since we begged for stars. iTunes reviews. I was looking at the UK store, so people in the UK, come on. I don't know what the US one looks like. I haven't been in there for a while, but I think we could use some fresh reviews in the UK store as well.
Yes, so we have all 5 stars in the iTunes store in the US, and you are called the Merlin Man of Educational Technology. And so, yeah, I would like to be the Dan Benjamin of Educational Technology. So if someone could write that review, that would be great. Just kidding.
Okay. So for me, find me online. Spears.org is my blog, and Fraser Spears on Twitter.
And I am Bradley Chambers on Twitter and chambersdaily.com on the web.
Cool. Let's talk to you all next week.
See ya.